Hello and welcome everyone to Masterclass tonight on May 11th, 2023. We have four presenters this evening and looking forward to hearing these topics are going to be great. I did put it in the agenda. I will fix it because we added one more. Abimbola will go ahead and do his too at the end. But we will start tonight with Alexander Montgomery, if you're ready.
Awesome. Yep. Ready and willing. All right. So this week, let me get this correct screen shared. I'll be talking about one of my favorite agile ideologies, extreme programming, and agile itself. So agile programming, sorry, extreme programming and agile both started roughly in the late 90s, and the name is very descriptive. If you think extreme, you're definitely going to think back to the 90s. The idea of extreme programming and agile was how do we remove a lot of the process and weight around software development and really focus on the core ideologies. So they ended up saying that simplicity, communication, feedback, respect, and courage were really the best attributes for building the best software possible. XP is an agile subset, which means it focuses on delivering a working software in short iterations and adapting to those changes requirements as quickly as possible. Working software above documentation and people above process is really agile compressed to a one-liner. XP encourages the use of coding standards and practices like refactoring, code reviews, and collective code ownership to really focus on code quality and reduce technical debt overall. The diagram on the right would be a kind of perspective flow on how you would go about prioritizing communication, of working out a feature, and actually talking, working together. So the Agile methodology was developed in the early 2000s as an alternate to traditional project management and software development methodologies. There were earlier reports of people that had claimed to develop Agile. GE was actually one of the first that said that they developed the Agile ideologies when they were contracted to build out the bullet trains for Japan in post-World War II. Their idea was remove all process, remove all documentation, and really let the engineers try to build the best thing that they could build. The engineer said, "You can't run a train at 200 miles an hour. Why?" "Well, because we have to take turns." "Well, did we tell you have to take turns?" And just that constant iteration to make improvements that ultimately resulted in the products being the best that it could. Agile emphasizes delivering working software in short iterations, like with XP, usually lasting from 1 to 4 weeks, typically referred to as a sprint. 2 seems to be the sweet spot in most organizations. Agile encourages very close collaboration between developers, customers, and stakeholders, usually through daily stand-up meetings and regular retrospectives. The reason they call them stand-up meetings is usually at the beginning of each meeting, you will stand up. You don't want to be standing up for too long, so you keep it nice, short, and sweet on a daily basis. Agile places more value to change an existing plan and encourages teams to be able to be more flexible and adaptable in the face of a changing requirement. If you have a waterfall-esque project and you try to change things in the 11th hour, it's not really going to be a good time. Agile is built with that in mind, where you kind of can pivot on a dime if your business objective no longer matches your ultimate need. Agile uses techniques such as user stories, product backlogs, and sprint planning to help manage and prioritize work to make sure the most valuable features are delivered first. So, extreme programming is a subset of Agile, but what really is the different pieces? Extreme programming is a lot more specific. It's kind of a technician's Agile, where it's very precise in how you should go about your regular operations, while Agile itself is a much broader term. It also includes more common versions of Agile, like Scrum or Kanban or Scrumban. XP introduces specific practices such as pair programming, TDD, and continuous integration as a requirement, while Agile doesn't really specify, but really emphasizes just a set of values and principles. XP has a much stronger emphasis on technical practices such as coding standards, linting practices, while Agile, once again, really just has that kind of 10,000 foot view saying you should collaborate, you should communicate, but not really any strong requirements on how or why. Customer involvement is at the forefront of XP, just about as close as it is with TDD, putting that strong focus on you working with your customer directly on a daily basis. And then practices such as frequent releases and user acceptance testing. While Agile doesn't really specify customer involvement, precisely. It recommends you work with your customer, but any kind of hard rule does not exist. And lastly, team sizes. XP is often used in smaller to tighter knit teams, the two pizza rule, while Agile can be used in teams of various sizes. The two pizza rule, for those aren't familiar, is you never really have more people in a team or a meeting than what you could comfortably feed with two medium pizzas. That keeps collaboration and communication at its peak and pinnacle. Sounds silly, but I swear it works. Testing and XP and the emphasis. So XP is really built around having the testing first. So it's one of the only methodologies that specifies, rather than coding, you code up your project, you check with the PO, you check with a stakeholder, and then eventually down the road, you write some documentation and test. Rather, the testing comes first. You write your test before you write your code, and you use your test to validate that your code is working properly. So you end up in a situation where you catch a lot more bugs and errors on the, what they typically refer to as shifting left, getting it in the dev side or getting in the IDE or NCI, which helps improve software quality and reduce the total likelihood of a defect after the fact. Continuous feedback. So you want to have your unit test and any kind of testing quality features baked into the code. So in a compiled environment, you say like C sharp or C Java, you want it to fail a build if your tests are not passing. You should be able to check it thoroughly and completely each and every time. So that feedback helps developers make their adjustments before they actually check it in, before it gets into main, before it gets into release. And collaboration. XP emphasizes collaboration, communication between developers, customers, and other stakeholders. It's at the very core of foundational fundamentals. And testing is considered that key part of collaboration. By involving your customers in testing and helping, I cannot speak tonight, and providing them with early access to working software, developers can get feedback and input that can help guide the development process. The goal of Agile is to get code in front of them as quickly as possible. Your MVP is to help them guide the product so you don't end up in a situation where you've built something for 3 months, the customer finally sees it, and they are not happy, and you're back to square one. And then lastly, that testing emphasis has that increased confidence. By testing as thoroughly as possible, developers can have a greater confidence in their code and in the final product. The confidence can really help team morale and can lead to greater customer satisfaction with the product. No one wants to own the monolith that can't deploy properly or has tons of problems. It's hard to kind of be proud of that kind of a product. But if you're building something that really doesn't have a lot of defects, it works well, there's just a sense of pride there. So for those that aren't familiar, on the right is the Agile testing pyramid. So your unit tests are your quick, easy, dirty tests. They are the closest to the code. They can provide logic checks, and they can be run extremely quickly. Above that, you have your service tests, so your integration or service-to-service test. So say your application is making a call to, say, the FedEx APIs. So this would be a test that starts your application, pings the FedEx API, and then checks that your service A can call it successfully, that auth's working, that the payloads match correctly, and do as many checks as it can there. And lastly, UI or E2E test or end-to-end. Those are your most expensive tests, but they do provide probably the most value, where those E2E test would be you have UI, you have your API, you turn everything on. Through the UI, it automatically will submit, say a form or something similar, and you will go through your API, run through all the logic flows, and then you double check the output in the UI. Those are the most expensive because you have to turn on the most things, but they do provide the highest grade of check to make sure that everything is working efficiently. By following that pyramid, you can really get to a really strong suite when you integrate it with the idea of continuous integration, or CI. CI is the first half of the common DevOps mantra, CI/CD, constant integration, constant deployment. Constant integration, so you pretty much every time you're submitting code back to your repository, you're running through all three suites of those tests. First, you run your unit test to figure out if there's any logic bugs in your code. Second, you check your service test to make sure your application starts. And finally, you run those E2E tests. By providing and following that testing pyramid, you ultimately end up in a situation to have a faster feedback loop, you have increased product quality and improved efficiency in terms of how much time you're fighting defects down the road. Easier collaboration, because it's easy to see whether or not a team member's code is going to work. Did it break the existing test? Is it stable? So on and so forth. And lastly, greater confidence that you're always in a situation where you are sure that your code is building on a machine that is not yours and it is stable. The other main core concept that I love in extreme programming is the code ownership aspect. So it's kind of funny. A couple years after I joined a strong agile shop, I stopped using the term I. It was never I wrote. It was never I worked on this. It was my team did this. It's a side effect of ultimately being completely responsible for everything that my team did. And meanwhile, they were in the same situation. Rather than individual responsibility, if your team had an issue, if your team's software failed, it is not that person's fault. It's not your team member's fault. It is our fault. And that shared responsibility ultimately kind of keeps everybody in check. It makes everyone responsible for the quality and maintainability of the code that goes in. XP also emphasizes code reviews, which if you are familiar with pull request, you will submit what you believe to be a change set. You run all your tests. CI will see whether or not anything was broken in that time. Does it build? Does it pass all of its the individual EDE tests? And this assures that every time you're merging back and forth between team members, you never really have to worry that you're going to be breaking something or changing something that ultimately breaks someone else. You've got this consistency in terms of review. And then lastly, pair programming, which is one of my absolute favorite concepts of XP, is that you get together with your devs and you sit down, two, three or more, and you go and work together on a single problem. You bounce your ideas off of them, and what ultimately comes out of that is way higher quality code, and it promotes knowledge sharing and to make sure that no one gets individually siloed in a particular project. So your entire team is up to date on and can work on any part of your application stack. Pre-COVID, it was one of my favorite things to do. I had two keyboards available on my desk at any time, at any given point. If someone had a problem, I would have them commit their stuff up to source control on a branch. They would come over, I'd clone it down, we'd have two keyboards, and we'd work it out. The ultimate rubber duck program. Customer involvement in XP. So XP emphasizes the importance of working directly with your customer. So rather than going through a product owner, you're working with the end client, the end user. This customer is involved in the development process from the very start. They are one of the primary stakeholders, and they work closely with the development team to provide feedback on the product as it's being developed. One of my favorite things to do when I had a new dev starting the company, intern through a senior, I would have them go spend a week with the actual client team. They would be trained as if they were going to be joining that group. And when they came out of that, they were in such a strong position to know what the software needed to do. No amount of documentation or kind of throwing words at them would have been able to compensate for actually training them on the software itself as if they were going to be an end user. User stories is one of the other ways that extreme programming can help capture requirements from the perspective of the end user. These stories are used to drive the development and are kind of written in collaboration with the customer to ensure they accurately reflect the needs of the user. So they would be phrased something akin to, as a dev, as a product owner, as a manager, as a client, and I want to see X, Y, and Z. And you would explain the reasons why I want to see X, Y, and Z. I need X, Y, and Z to fill in these reports. And that would then ultimately be able to put you in the mindset to be able to better deliver. Because especially within waterfall projects or large specs, it's hard to jump into the visualization of those users of what they actually need to really see why they need something, not just what they think that they need, but why they need it. The planning phase. So XP uses a game to help the development team and customers work together to plan the development iteration. This game ultimately is done on a regular period of time to prioritize the stories for each piece. Usually what we would do is we would play Tetris with each of the individual projects. So we would say, okay, this has the highest weight, this kind of shape, and actually kind of work our way down so that you could see how something that is, you know, high value, low like low cost versus your high cost, low values, and you'd be able to see how much you could pack in a 3-month period and get the best results there. Continuous feedback. So XP really does emphasize the importance of hearing back from the customer on a regular basis. This can kind of manifest in a weekly review or a demo of each individual feature so that the client always is seeing that value, which goes into the next piece, which is in incremental development. You want to take a small individual win, something that delivers back to the user where they can get some feature and deliver that as frequently as possible. Big bang releases are awesome because you can have everything go out the same door. You can do all your quality checks, but the user no longer sees that continuous value of having you on that team. So having incremental development where you're working on small pieces of the features and then innovating off of them ultimately results in a much more stable and much happier client. In conclusion, Agile and XP both focus on flexibility, collaboration, that iterative development, continuous integration, customer focus, and rapid delivery. The two together are extremely powerful in certain circumstances, and in most cases, it is one of the better project management frameworks to use. There are a couple constraints in cases like government or cases where you have to have a very rigid development process that Agile is not really built for, but for anything in the actual open market, it is an absolute savior for software. If you're curious about it, there are two guys that I would almost hold as idle status, Martin Fowler and Robert C. Martin. Both those names, if you're not familiar with them, you should definitely check them out. Martin Fowler is one of the original authors of the Agile Manifesto and has some of the better ideas. The testing pyramid actually came from a lot of his development. And then Robert C. Martin, or Uncle Bob, is one of the pinnacles and pillars of software engineering and development. He is the author of the Clean Code series and is considered one of the more respected proponents of extreme programming. All right. Thank you guys so much. Is there any questions?
Excellent job. I wasn't aware of a lot of this.
Yeah, I've been using Agile for most of my professional career, everywhere except for the DoD. And honestly, if you do extreme programming right, you'll never want to do anything else.
Wow, that's interesting. See, there's always a good topic. Learn something new. Excellent job.
All right. It doesn't sound like there's any questions. If you guys have any follow-ups, just feel free to reach out. Thank you so much. And a special thank you to Jonathan. His talk last week inspired me to go with this particular topic.
Ah, yes. Yep, very good. Okay. We'll stay in the line of Alexander and see if Alexander Vance is ready.
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
All right, I'm going to share my screen. All right, so my masterclass is on the man in the middle and ARP spoofing attack. Table context, a few things I'm going to cover is what is a man in the middle attack? What is ARP spoofing? I'm going to do a demo on how to execute this type of attack and then kind of talk about how to prevent a man in the middle attack. So what is a man in the middle attack? An attack in which an attacker is positioned between two communicating parties in order to intercept and or alter data traveling between them. So I believe most people think of a rogue access point or an evil twin when thinking about a man in the middle attack. A rogue access point is when an unauthorized access point is installed on an existing network. An example of this would be if an employee or attacker connects a router to an unsecured network port in an office or cubicle, and then uses that wireless access point to gain access to the company network. An evil twin is when you use the name of a existing SSID to kind of trick or social engineer a victim to connecting to that network instead of the real network. You often see this done with Wi-Fi pineapples or Wi-Fi coconuts. For all my Silicon Valley TV show fans, there was a great episode where they used a bunch of Wi-Fi pineapples to launch a man in the middle attack against hundreds of people at a tech convention. What is ARP spoofing? Address resolution protocol spoofing, or ARP poisoning, is a form of a spoofing attack that hackers use to intercept data. A hacker commits an ARP spoofing attack by tricking one device into sending messages to the hacker instead of the intended recipient. So art spoofing is just one of the types of attack you can launch after successfully executing a man-in-the-middle attack. During my demo, I'm going to use art spoofing to redirect traffic from the victim's PC to a fake website using a website template that already exists. Well, I will then capture their login credentials. So this demo is not to teach you how to launch a man-in-the-middle attack, but to show you how easy it is and give recommendations on simple security measures you could take to prevent it. I used to think that someone would try to hack someone else's Wi-Fi just to get free Wi-Fi. You also hear about not using open Wi-Fi networks because you could be hacked, but who really knows how to do that? I'm not going to assume that there's a hacker that shares the same coffee shop that I do, so why should I be worried? These are the questions that would come to mind whenever I read or heard about people hacking Wi-Fi. This demo is to show you how easy it is to capture your information using a man-in-the-middle and art spoofing attack from just being on the same network as an attacker. I'm going to start this demo. Please give me a thumbs up if you can hear the audio. So for this demo, I have a Kali Linux virtual machine and a Windows 10 VM that are both running in VirtualBox. The tool within Kali Linux that...
Can you guys hear the audio?
We can.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
It's going to help me launch a man-in-the-middle attack and the ARP spoofing attack. It's called BetterCap. So I'm going to go ahead and run BetterCap as sudo user, root user. And the first command I'm going to enter is called netprobe. And it's going to probe the network to see all the endpoints or all the devices on that network. So here you can start to see all the IP addresses of the devices. And then my next command, I'm going to run a net show. And it's not only going to show the IP addresses, but it's going to include the MAC address. So you can see devices like my Philips Hue lights, as well as my Windows VM, which is this 192.168.0.48 address. So let's go ahead and launch that man-in-the-middle/ARP spoofing attack. I'm going to do this by the command set ARP spoof target and then the IP address that I mentioned previously, 192.168.0.48. After I've entered this command, I'm going to turn the ARP spoof on by ARP.spoof space on. And I've now have my Kali Linux VM between my Windows VM and the gateway device. So if I wanted to, I can sniff the network from here, see all the traffic inbound and outbound from that Windows device. The next tool I'm going to use is going to create a fake website. There's a tool called Social Engineering Toolkit, aka SET, that I'm going to go ahead and open up. Once running, I'm going to select option 1 for social engineering attack, and then I'm going to select option 2 for website attack vectors. I'm going to be doing a credential harvesting attack, so I'll select option 3. And then, as I mentioned before, I'm going to use a pre-made template, so I'm going to select web templates option 1. So the IP address that I'm going to be hosting this website from is the Kali Linux VM itself. So I'll do a quick ifconfig to see what my IP address is. You can see right there, 192.168.0.251. Go ahead and enter that IP address back into that social engineering toolkit application. And it has 3 options for templates they've already created. I'm going to go ahead and select option 2 for Google. All right, I now have this running from the Kali Linux VM. Let's go ahead and pull up my Windows VM. If I go to that IP address of the Kali Linux, the 192.168.0.251, you'll now see it pulls up google.com or a fake page of Google. No one's actually going to type in that IP address and mistakenly go to Google, which brings us to our last step, which is the ARP spoofing part of the domain google.com. So I'm going to go back into the BetterCap tool. I'm going to set DNS spoof domain for that domain, google.com. I'm going to then turn the DNS spoof on. I made a quick typo. DNS.spoof space on. There we go. So you can now see Google's being spoofed to that IP address of the Kali Linux machine. So if I bring back up my Windows machine and go to google.com, it'll now go to my fake google.com website. If I enter my credentials, bring back up my Linux social engineering tool, and you can see here it captured that username and password that I just entered. Let's see if I can bring up my Windows VM and the Kali Linux to kind of show both at the same time. I'm going to type in email address, just user, and password, please don't hack me. And as soon as I hit enter, you can then see user, please don't hack me. So this is a quick, easy example of how an attacker can use credential harvesting. And again, they can spoof more than, you know, google.com. They can spoof Wells Fargo. They can spoof Bank of America, Facebook, anything that attacker would want to gain your username and password. They can set up fake websites and then ARP spoof those domains to redirect to the sites that they created, and then easily collect your username and password. So aside from staying off public networks and using a VPN, aside from staying off public networks, using a VPN would prevent any type of man-in-the-middle attack. This demo was not meant to scare anyone to the threats that are out there, but just to rather educate you on how easy some of them are. A real attacker would not only set up a fake website, but they would then redirect you to the real one after the first login attempt. So an example would be, if you go to login to Wells Fargo and you click login or submit, it then sends the attacker your credentials and redirects you to the real site. So when you try logging in again, it is successful. This way you access the resource you need and are completely unaware that those credentials are now compromised. During the cryptocurrency boom, it was really common for attackers to set up fake websites for the different crypto sites to purchase and send coins. Because if they harvest your credentials, the attacker could send or transfer the victim's cryptocurrency to a cold storage wallet that was practically untraceable. My sister, about 2 years ago, was hacked because she got a pop-up on her computer telling her she had a virus and to call a number. She called the phone number and they emailed her a link that would allow them to remotely access her PC. Not knowing, she granted them access, and after about an hour, they said the virus had been removed and she was all set. She told me the story a day later and I wanted to cry. I felt so bad that I had not informed her of these types of social engineering attacks. So education is the best way to make sure you don't fall victim to an attack. And that was the purpose of this presentation. These are a couple of references I used for my quotes. And any questions?
Awesome job.
Yes, excellent job. That was great.
Thank you.
It's always good to see exactly how you can get spoofed. Bradley, did you have a question?
I hit the wrong button trying to give applause.
No problem. All right. Excellent job. Okay, Nicholas, are you ready?
I guess I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
All righty, go right ahead.
Second. All right. And everybody can see that? And I assume so.
Yes.
All right, cool. So, hey, everybody. My presentation is going to be on Radius Network Authentication. To get started, what is Radius? Radius, or Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service, is a network access service that requires unique user authentication. This access is authenticated through a Radius server, which you would set up in your domain, which checks credentials and certificates for every user connection. This authentication is supported through all primary forms of access, which include remote access, wireless, and wired connections on your server / policy setup. Radius is considered a AAA protocol, which it means that it covers the usage of requests that involve the authentication, authorization, and accounting for connection requests. Under the general guidelines of the AAA standard, there are two primary packet types: the access request packet type, which covers the needs of the authentication and authorization needs, while the accounting request packet type does the same, but specifically for accounting. We'll get more into that later on. Optionally, as an inclusion to these required AAA standard sections, you can also implement additional requirements for extra information through a request with different types of users based on policy setup. So, for example, you could have a more strict policy for remote access employees in comparison to on-site employees. Some examples of information that you could request in a policy setup like this would be things like their current network address, phone number, etc. But why would you do Radius? Radius, while implementation can be considered daunting, provides a considerable upgrade in authentication and access management with users. As well as this, Radius is a strong way to centralize authentication, requiring users to follow Radius policy guidelines to gain network access of any time, of any kind, and with access policy requirements being adjusted as needed. The implementation of a Radius server also eliminates concerns of using an SSID with shared credentials, as Radius requires unique credentials per every user. Radius, while being a major increase in security for network use, does come with some general negatives. The primary issues that many administrators mention is the difficult implementation of Radius policies. It is normally recommended that Radius be implemented by an experienced team who have used Radius in the past, as the process of implementation can be considerably complicated and varies from network to network. Along with this, it is considered difficult to implement with pre-existing credential databases, such as Active Directory, as being highly recommended for implementation with new network setups over pre-existing ones. Even so, while it can be difficult, it's not something impossible. It's more of something that they just recommend if you are planning on doing an implementation like this, because first of all, it is such a significant leap in security for your network. Trying to get somebody with some experience in implementing something like this or maintaining is very highly recommended. But how does Radius work? In this example, we will be following the request process for a staff member using their laptop to connect to a wireless access point to receive access. To start, the staff member would use their unique credentials to request access to the wireless network through a designated SSID, whichever one. You can technically have it set up with multiple SSIDs if you have it in a specific sense, as long as you have the policy set up to connect to the Radius server to request credentials. After you try to connect to the SSID and the user puts in their credentials, it will move this request to the network access server, or Radius server, which would handle the request. The request from there would take that provided credentials and compare it to the user database. In a Windows environment, that would be likely Active Directory. But if you were using something like a Linux environment, you might have something like an OpenSQL database or similar to handle the same type of database rolling. And approving the connection with the match credentials it finds. The next two steps generally happen at about the same time. Once the credentials have been confirmed, the approval is sent back to the wireless access point. And at the same time, that request, while it's being approved, it is sending an account of that actually occurring, basically an audit log, to the accounting database to say, hey, this person did try to connect and was successful, so that if, in case of, let's say, somebody potentially using somebody else's credentials to get in and finding out that somebody's been hacked or similar, you will be able to go back and review those contents. Finally, the requester gains access to the network, completing the authentication process. So what would the implementation of Radius generally entail? For this, I'm going to use a Windows environment installation, for example, as Microsoft provides their own first-party solution for Radius authentication. To start off, as with any service, it's important to ensure that any server system requirements are met. Thankfully, with Radius, it is a very lightweight program. And most instances that you see, they usually throw it on the same server that you would normally be hosting your Active Directory suite. And it's a lot more convenient to have it with that, as you don't have to have it, you know, jump off to other servers to actually, you know, complete requests. So normally they kind of throw it on the same server as your Active Directory database or whatever database you actually are hosting your credentials in. With Active Directory services connected for use with the user database, there are three primary server modules required to install and configure. These modules include Active Directory, of course, the actual database, certificate services for Active Directory, and the network policy server, which in this case, the network policy server is Microsoft's version of the Radius server. So the idea is that Active Directory is the database in this scenario. The certificates are created with Active Directory to confirm that request. Like basically when it goes to pull that request, when somebody goes and tries to log in, it will connect using the network policy server, reach out to the Active Directory certificate services to pull the credentials, make sure that they're accurate and that they're actually active. And that way it's able to confirm that this person is supposed to be on the network, that they did provide proper credentials. Then after all that, you can, in network policy server is kind of where you would be focusing on creating any policy additions. In more high risk businesses or ones that have, I would say government would be a good inclusion, they would probably have a lot more significant policies in place in comparison to a business due to the, following government security standards when it comes to logging into high security clearance networks. So the before and after, the network's security infrastructure shifts from a very hands-on shared password SSID format to a centralized user database. When completing a task like this, implementation isn't as simple as just picking it up and running with it. It takes a lot of planning, and it would require a great deal of, you know, testing beforehand. So my main question is how would policies be changed or implemented around an integration like this? So to start, with any significant security adjustment, it's important to review existing security policies and processes to ensure that the information contained would fit the implementation of the Radius server service that you have in mind. So one of the more important policies principles that you see in businesses, the principle of least privilege, dictates that users should only be provided access to network resources as required by their position. It would be important to review how those network access policies may need to be adjusted to reflect how users access the network, whether people, for example, remote users or similar, how they're actually accessing, whether that connection has to have a more limited policy setup, what they can actually access on the network in comparison to somebody that is actually on site. And those policies could be configured uniquely based on credentials based for specific roles. You can set up technically multiple different policy setups based for different, you know, sets of users, especially through how Active Directory works. So you can kind of do some in that and also some in the network policy server section for Radius. This could also be another way that you could work with network access to external vendors, as monitored network access for them may be considerably easier with Radius, seeing that you'd be with, you know, external vendors, you would be providing them specified credentials to access your network for a short period, whether it's to implement. I know in some cases for like my work, I have vendors come in every so often, they have to put in specialized like projector equipment or similar for some of our events, and they have to have access to our network for a short period of time. With something like this, we would be able to give them access to an account that they could use to specifically connect to our network. We don't have to give them a chance to have our special, you know, our specific shared SSID credentials. We just get them a unique account. We would already have to have done that anyways. And that way, going into the, you know, going through that, we would be hitting an extra security checkpoint in comparison to having to trust that they're not going to use, you know, this access to farm our credentials and therefore, you know, maintain access in our system. So as an example piece, let's say that we were implementing this into an environment that previously had a shared SSID. Previous policy may have included information regarding general acceptable use, stating that IT/cyber staff would have to be contacted to provide the password to any needed devices to ensure that misuse is mitigated, etc. With that in mind, that policy would need to adjust the point of contact and setup method in reference of using the centralized system, possibly with inclusions such as more frequent password changes, along with any additional criteria that may have been added during the policy discussion phase. Pre-implementation. Basically, if there were any specialized for people outside of the network, like those remote users or somebody, you know, these unique setups, you might have to make inclusion for any of those additional criteria, whether you follow and keep up on network addresses or similar when having individuals connect. Overall, final thoughts, I would recommend if it's something that it's not already been implemented at your place of work, Radius is a good inclusion and a significant security improvement. With enough time and proper testing, it would lead to a more secure and manageable access structure for core network services on your network. Does anyone have any questions? Sounds like a no. Cool.
Very interesting. Again, my goodness. Excellent job.
Yeah, no problem. And thanks for listening to me, everybody. Here's all my references.
All right. Great, great job. Yeah. All right. Okay. Abimbola?
Are you ready? Good evening. I'm here.
Okay.
All right, let me share my screen. All right. Can you see me, please?
Yes.
Can you see my screen?
Yes, I do.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Good evening, everybody. My presentation is centered upon a very interesting topic, which is actually dear to me. And it's titled Artificial Intelligence and Its Privacy Concerns. I believe we all heard about the new age of technology, which is artificial intelligence. We believe that the nearest future is going to take over some certain things. It's actually started now, and we, one way or the other, have been feeling the effects of artificial intelligence, probably in a negative or in a positive way. So I would like to look into this as my presentation. So any discussion on cybersecurity is usually inclusive of data creation and privacy, because cybersecurity seeks to protect data systems and infrastructure by preventing manipulation from unscrupulous and malicious actors. And privacy, on the other hand, I can say, is the right to keep confidential and personal information free from unauthorized access. Artificial intelligence has become prevalent in several areas of our lives, having the capacity to revolutionize the manner with which we all interact with technology. And the amount of data generated through online sharing is increasing exponentially, as we all know, and so does the privacy risks it presents. So therefore, it is necessary to delve into how AI impacts our privacy and personal data. So in this presentation, I will examine the benefits and the risks associated with AI with regards to privacy and the security steps that we can employ as individuals, corporate bodies, and even the government to secure privacy and protect personal data in the new technology age. So I'll continue by looking into how it works. So AI software depends on machine learning algorithms, and they are trained on an enormous amount of data, that is big data, as we all know. So sometimes they contain biases, which could lead to questionable inequalities and even discrimination against race and color. And so these tools collect and analyze data, which includes personal information, images, and other sensitive data that users enter as prompts and are used to train generative AI models. So we have generative AI tools like ChatGPT, which is the most popular, and also Stable Diffusion, which enables individuals to create content that mimics human-produced media, which are usually not transparent in the use of the actual user data. So to the next slide, benefits of AI. So we are all familiar with the benefits in this digital age, as data has become a valuable commodity. So data emanates from a variety of sources, which includes our online activities, our social media platforms, and public records. So AI relies on these varieties of data to make tangible decisions. So online sharing of information through our social interaction, trade, entertainment, and even political activities has allowed individuals and even business as a whole to gain a better insight and the need to establish better decisions. So however, and the numerous amounts of this data shared daily contains sensitive information that many individuals do not want to share, which is where the aspect of privacy comes in. So I will talk a little bit about the advantages of AI to big tech companies, which is at the detriment of many users. So big tech companies such as Google and Amazon has access to numerous amounts of data, which can give them, like, say, unprecedented power to influence consumer behavior and shape the global economy. So, and their involvement in policies can also shape public opinions and mold governmental policy. So, and the development also can allow these big tech companies to leverage their data and influence. And it can also allow them to build new ecosystems and control user experience and even monetize their platforms. So another great benefit of AI is the fight against crime and terrorism. A controversial use of AI technology has brought a significant change to law enforcement and security, which helps to fight against crime and terrorism. And because AI software uses data analysis and machine learning to predict areas of crime occurrences, and who could be likely be responsible for a crime. So these tools gather large amounts of data from cameras, social media sources to predict crime before they occur. So those are the benefits we can actually derive from AI. So now talking about the main point, which is the privacy concerns in our AI age. Privacy would mean is an exercise of control over private and valuable information. So privacy means we are also allowed to maintain our social and professional relationships without any fear of interference and surveillance. And by also privacy, we mean that the dangers of unauthorized access, if data gets into the wrong hands, is another concern, which could result into theft and fraud. So despite the numerous benefits of AI, challenges to its use can be damaging in that if data falls into the wrong hands, it can be used also for cyberbullying. So toxic recommendation engines will also be used to analyze our data and use it to manipulate individuals into making certain buying decisions. So the advancements of AI has shifted to using complex algorithms to make decisions based on subtle patterns, in that data are difficult for humans to discern, which implies that human will not be aware that their personal data is used to initiate decisions that are affected. So examples of such, we can see in Google location tracking practice and the invasive nature of Google, such as Google suggested engine. Sometimes when you watch a show on Apple TV, for instance, and suddenly you receive news recommendations on your iPhone that was not even used to watch the show. So those are certain kinds of the invasive nature of Google. So, and I'm talking about the bias, concerns, and discrimination that AI poses in the new technology. So AI systems are typically unbiased as the data are trained on. So it becomes biased, so will be the resulting systems. So this could generate unfair and harmful outcomes on individuals based on race, gender, religion, political beliefs, and even socioeconomic status. So AI systems can generate systemic inequality, especially in the hiring process. That's becoming more common now. For instance, if an AI system is used by a hiring company to screen job applications, and the system is biased against, for instance, women or people of color, it may use data about a candidate's gender or race to unfairly exclude them from consideration. Now, this is another popular one that many people are experiencing now, job displacement and economic disruptions. As AI approaches advancement, and they are immensely capable of performing tasks that have previously been carried out by humans, which could lead to a tremendous economic disruption and aggravated financial insecurity for workers, which can further lead to a situation where individuals can sacrifice their privacy to earn a living in a changing economy. And for instance, a worker who has lost their jobs to automation may be forced to disclose their job history and even location to pursue other jobs, which could also raise some serious privacy concerns as their information could be used by third parties or for target ads. So we all know it's no longer new that AI algorithms are also utilized by certain organizations for hiring process to screen job candidates by analyzing their online behavior and social media activities to establish their sustainability or suitability for the job roles. Sorry. So this may generate certain concerns regarding the data being used, and those applications will not be aware that data is being used in a certain way. So, in terms of surveillance, you see AI systems could pose some certain privacy risk when it comes to surveillance. AI is a welcome development we all accept, but it's crucial to acknowledge that these systems could pose potential risk for fundamental rights and freedom. A major concern with the use of AI-based surveillance system is significant risk to privacy and civil liberties by monitoring and controlling individuals, thereby making them lose freedom and their civil liberties. Recently, the European Union, with a view to protect individual privacy in the AI age, initiated a proposal to ban the use of AI surveillance in public places, except in cases where there's a specific public threat. And since AI-based surveillance are not transparent, individuals do not know when they are being monitored and for what purpose. So this decision can erode trust in law enforcement and security agencies, and even create a sense of unease in the general public. So I have some few recommendations which I would like to highlight. It's a good idea if we could encourage big tech companies to be transparent about data practices. And also, it is important for AI systems to be trained on diverse data and be regularly audited to prevent bias. And thirdly, organizations and companies utilizing AI technology must employ proactive measures to implement strong data security protocols, which is aimed at ensuring that data is only used for the intended purpose. They should also endeavor to design AI systems that adhere to ethical principles. Now, also, with respect to transparency, users should have control over their data by understanding its use and being able to renounce data collection, and also request to have their data deleted whenever and wherever they feel. So in view of this, AI technology can be used to the greater benefits of society. Also, I would like to take this to address the concern of AI surveillance technology. Like I mentioned the other time, the use of AI must have strict regulations and an establishment of an independent oversight and review mechanism can also help to ameliorate its privacy concerns. They mustn't also forget that the implementation of strict regulations and oversight mechanisms is a vital step towards creating a future where AI technologies are used to the benefit of society without compromising individual rights and freedoms. And ultimately, in the healthcare sector, there are several challenges of privacy issues. So decentralized AI like blockchain can be used to securely share patients' data while protecting their privacy. And lastly, users generally, that is very important for everyone, users must be aware of the dangers of sharing personally identifiable information online. And if need be, use privacy tools to opt out of target advertising to limit data sharing, especially by third-party companies. I have a final statement. As AI continues to evolve, it is crucial that we must all be vigilant in addressing the challenges introduced by AI to ensure that it is used for the greater good rather than for nefarious purposes that could possibly affect our rights to privacy. I'll end my presentation here. I don't know if anyone has questions. I have some few references here. One from Regina Mack and the other one from Kerry Cameron. Thank you. Any questions, please?
Very interesting. You know, AI is such a big topic these days, and it's always good to know more and more information about it that we can find. So this is excellent as well. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Any questions for any of our speakers tonight? Okay, well, I thank all of our presenters tonight and their wonderful presentations. They picked some great topics and excellent job, excellent work. I'm so proud of you guys. And I believe your instructors will be happy about it as well. So great job. And thanks for joining everybody for another wonderful masterclass tonight. And have a great weekend.
Have a great night, all.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.